Right, everybody, welcome back to This Week in Startups. It's time for Startup Basics with my friend, Becky DeGraw. She is counsel from Wilson Sonsini Goodrich & Rosati, WSGR, as we call it. People say Wilson Sonsini here in the Valley. Becky, one of the things we're seeing is distressed companies. I'm on the board of some of these, and this crazy moment happens when it's pretty clear that this plane is not going to make it across the Atlantic Ocean and land safely. To use a dark metaphor, it's not life or death, but all of a sudden, I look to my left and my right, and two VCs and an independent director just took their parachutes and jumped out the back of the plane, and I'm sitting in the cockpit with the two co-founders, and we got to do something with this plane. So maybe you could talk about, why do some certain VCs just leave the board? Company's not out of business, but they're clearly struggling, and there's this like perception, hey, we're not going to make it. It's going to be a pretty rough landing. So let's talk about distressed companies in that final 6 months.
Yeah. Now, unfortunately, we're having more of these conversations in this macro environment that we're in. But I think if you find yourself either as a director or officer in one of those companies heading in that direction, your job becomes much more difficult, right, on a number of fronts. You know, anytime you start taking actions, they're going to be looked at with greater scrutiny, right? Oftentimes, it's insiders that come to the rescue from a financing perspective. And we've got insider-led down rounds and recaps and these things because it's like, hey, you're running out of money. There's no other options. The terms get more aggressive, more punitive, more dilutive, higher risk for claims later. The other thing that goes along with that, right, of we're tend to be like more complex, more creative. Whenever you do that from a legal perspective, your legal fees start going up. And it's like, that's the worst time to have bigger and bigger legal fees. But oftentimes, you know, you start having more regular board meetings because you need to have a good record showing what you're doing, that you're paying attention, that you're well informed, that you're looking at all of these things. But man, it takes a lot of time, a lot of resources, and starts pushing up. And to your point, some investors say, all right, I've already written this investment off. The whole point of me staying on the board was somewhat of an oversight function for my investment. If I've written it off and me staying on is pure liability, I think that's something to weigh, you know, from a company perspective.
And that's when people pull the ripcord. It's like, we've written this down to zero, and it's going to take my time. It's going to take energy. And these situations are 50 times more distracting, and they have 100 times the bad feelings. Pay to play keeps happening. Maybe you could explain to the audience what this pay to play scenario is, this last ditch effort in some companies that creates massive bad feelings, and, you know, why people do it and should they do it? You know, what's your take here?
Yeah. I mean, we are seeing more pay to plays, particularly in connection with down rounds. It's usually, you know, the company needs money. Nobody else is coming to the table. The insiders are doing this, pointing to each other like, are you going to go? Because I'm not going by myself. I'm not going to carry the full weight of this. You got to come along and help too. And some investors are like, I'm not helping. No, I'm not putting good money after bad money. But at the end of the day, like the company needs a certain amount of money too to get to whatever that next hopeful step is going to be. So when we put a pay to play in place, we're essentially saying, we want you to participate in this financing, for your pro rata. And if you don't, something bad is going to happen. There's all sorts of what we can fill in the blank with that, something bad. But oftentimes it's, we're going to convert your preferred stock to common stock. And it may be not that we're converting on a one-to-one basis. We can start messing with that ratio too. Say for every 10 shares of preferred, you're only going to get one share of common. And then for the folks that participate, maybe we pull up, we call it, essentially like turn that common stock back into preferred stock. Again, it may not be a one-for-one basis, but that's kind of the general concept of the pay-to-play and why it comes in to place, because this company needs money and I'm kind of going to going to use a stick to force you to help support this company at this time.
It's really rough. I've been in a lot of these situations the last 2 years, and I have never seen a pay-to-play round result in a win for the company afterwards.
It's few and far between. It's very risky from an investor perspective, putting money in at that point.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you learn, I'm going into my second decade as an investor here, and I think what I've learned is if we are at that point, this is not going to work out. And so we really should be talking about a sale or a shutdown. But, you know, hey, founders might have a white knight and they say, hey, we've got, you know, $1 million in revenue. We've got a broken cap table and this white knight wants to put $1 million in, and that $1 million will get us to profitability. I want to keep going. You say, well, there's already $10 million in overhang in the company, and that $10 million represents 40% of the cap table. Well, you know what? Of that $10 million, you know, each person who put in $1 million, now they're 10% of that new round, right? Or something to that effect. Let's say that if I were to do the math, that $10 million bought, let's say, 20% of the company. Each point would be 2%, or each million would be 2%. Therefore, you have to take 2% of the new round, which means if you put in 5 million, you got to put in 2 times 5, 10. You got to put in some money to this next round in order to keep your shares. And if not, you go to common. And some people just might not be willing to do that. That fund is fully deployed, or they just see this as super liability. If they are successful, have you seen people or amongst your contemporaries, other firms, other situations when you're chewing the fat and having a beverage after libation to drown the sorrow of some of these days? That can go pretty long. You have a double Macallan or whatever your jam is. Do you see legal action afterwards? Hey, you guys did this pay-to-play round. It worked out. It's one of the 1 in 50 or 100 that do work out. Hey, you know what? Maybe we'll send a couple legal letters and get our shares back. Has that happened?
That was what I was going to say, is the ironic thing is vast majority, I feel like, we go through all these efforts, the pay to play, the recap, whatever hoops we might jump through, the legal fees that it takes to do all of it. And then the company doesn't pan out right from there. Let's just say they are one in the few that do, and like, yes, success story. They pulled the rabbit out of the hat. They're doing great. That's the time when we start to worry about, uh-oh, are the stockholder lawsuits going to come? Because the stockholders aren't going to file a lawsuit when there's nothing there, when the company did a nosedive, right?
Like, can't get blood from a rock stone.
Exactly. Right? So, but in the scenario where the company is actually successful in turning it around, then you're like, oh boy, now I got to deal with this. And that's where I will say I'm spending a lot of my time right now, of having those conversations of the plan for the worst case scenario. Well, plan for the best case scenario, which also might be your worst case scenario from a legal perspective. And what are some things that we should be doing while we're going through this process to help mitigate the bad result that could come from that? And one of the things that I say to everybody, and that is one of the most important things that you can do, and there's all sorts of different mitigation techniques or things that we can do, but have a good process. Make it the best process possible. Like, right, you may not be able to control the outcome in terms of like what the terms are and all of those things.
But you can get everybody to sign off on it. And that is the key, is to get this unanimous. So, hey, listen, you are not going to do the pay to play. You don't want to participate. We get it. You're leaving the board. You need to sign a piece of paper that says you're leaving the board, and you need to sign a piece of paper that you had the opportunity to buy shares and you did not.
Yeah, we would love to see all of that. And sometime, right, like it's run a good process and make sure it's reflected in the board minutes too, right? So going out and doing a market check before you just, it's easier to accept the money from the insiders. I know it's a down round, but it's easier than me going out and checking whether there's anybody else.
Explain a market check. I know what it means, but for the audience and for founders, what is a market check? Yeah.
Yeah. So it's where let's say you need to raise money. You actually go out and you talk to a number of investors. Maybe you hire an investment bank to help you with that process as well. And sometimes we see the companies that will do that and actually, like, right, you're talking to, you go out and you talk to 30 investors and every single one of them says, no, not interested, not even getting past first conversation. Document that. I know you don't want to air your dirty laundry, but that is so important to have that in the board minutes because it paints the story of this truly was a financing of last resort. The only people that were coming to the table were our insiders. We couldn't attract it from anybody else. And yeah, you know what? It was really risky and the terms were a little punitive, but there wasn't anything else on the table.
And I've had founders who come to me and they propose one of these things and it feels like they're self-dealing. And then I say, okay, who did you talk to for M&A? What bank did you hire? Who were the people? Where's the Google sheet that tracked all this? They're like, well, we had a couple of conversations. And I'm like, great. Let me know which ones you had. I want to see the emails from them saying they're not interested. I want you to document all that. And they're like, oh, well, yeah, you know, you don't trust us. And it's like, okay, let's not make this emotional, everybody. We're not in kindergarten. This isn't high school. This is business. And you need to document. We emailed these 30 investors. We followed up with each one with two subsequent emails. We got 10 meetings. We took those 10 meetings. They turned into 4 second meetings. Those 4 declined to invest at any price. These are the reasons those 4 people gave us of why they weren't investing. And it's in an addendum attached to, it's in a Google sheet somewhere, it's in a Notion page, whatever. This is not rocket science to do this. And man, does this cover you? And I have been through this so many times where, you know, founders do this. And I've been through it a couple of times where founders don't do it. And then they propose, hey, their friend's going to put in 500K. They're going to put in 250K. They recap the company. And I'm like, well, which investors did you talk to? Oh, you don't trust me? Oh, God. Trust but verify.
And I mean, like, it is real liability to the directors and officers that were watching, that were approving. Like, what you just said would be, I would love to see that spreadsheet, send it out to the board, have the email, have the board minutes say, after reviewing the Google sheet that was about the investor outreach, the board decided to do X. Like, that's like, give our litigators a chance.
That's the gold standard. You know, and if it did come down to litigation, you have opposing counsel file or they, you know, you do some sort of phone call, they write a letter and you say, listen, you know, this is going to come out in discovery. Do you have the board docs? And they're like, no. And okay, great. Let me share the board docs with you. Here it is. Were you aware that this existed, a Google sheet with 30 targets? And are you aware that they had second meetings with these 4 and these 4 said they were declining for these reasons? I was like, no, I wasn't aware of that. Okay, great. So before you file, you should know that this occurred. And so these claims maybe are less valid or not valid at all.
Yeah. And I mean, it may not be a complete get out of jail free card, but it is one of the best things that we advise of, like, again, we may not be able to control the terms as the company. Like, we may end up having to take some really punitive, aggressive things, but at least control the process so that we can have the best possible look there.
As a steward of capital, let me get free legal advice from you here. I've had a couple of situations where I disagree and I've said, we are a launch fund with X percent ownership. This has happened, you know, 5 times in 400 companies, which, you know, have some number of rounds of financing. So we're talking about thousands of rounds of financing. I say, yeah, we're voting we're opposed to this. So we're voting in opposition to it. And the founder's like, really? And I'm like, yeah, for this reason. We don't believe that this is, you know, we don't think you should be selling secondary and raising money. And we think you should have gone with the other deal that didn't have the secondary offering in it because we think it's bad hygiene. So we're voting against this. But we understand that we own 6% and, you know, whatever, you needed 80% or something to, and we're getting dragged along. I'm like, oh, we talked to our counsel. They said you need to vote for it. And I'm like, actually, we don't. This is how governance works. So maybe you can talk a little bit about when you have somebody like me, a conscientious objector, who says, I just can't vote in this, or I'm going to abstain from voting, or I think I did abstaining once. And then I voted no maybe twice in the history of what we've done. It was pretty severe. I'll leave it at that. So what do you think of that situation where you have a board director who says, listen, I just can't vote for this?
Yeah, I mean, ideally, from company and director perspective, is you have those conversations outside of an actual formal board approval. And you find a way to get there from a compromise perspective. Like, I would be shocked And I'd be curious to know in the case where you did vote no, if the investor on the other side said, oh, yeah, cool, I'm all right with that still, if one of the directors that voted no.
I think this was a spin out. You know, they wanted to spin the company out and the amount of equity they were giving. So there was like two products inside the company. The founders left to go do this other company with the asset from this company, gave the existing investors like 20%. And I was like, well, what's going to happen to this shell of the company that we own 10% of? It's like, it's going to zero essentially because nobody's going to be here to run it. And I'm like, well, that seems profoundly unfair. You just took the one asset and moved it over here. And then you guys own 80%. The new investors own 15%. The previous investors own 5%. Why don't we just stay in this cap table and just shut that other business down? Like, oh, well, because we won't own enough equity. We got too much of an overhang. And I was like, okay, I vote no. And you know, that's still hanging out there. And so to our point earlier, and I said no, because if our LPs came to us and said, do you allow this? I didn't want to have the liability saying I allowed it. I wanted to have on the record that I voted against it, that there was an email that said, here's the reasons why. And if that company becomes worth $1 billion, to your point before, you know, we would be able to then make a claim.
Yeah. And I mean, like there's the board vote and the stockholder vote, and depending on which hat you're wearing, right, at the board level, you've got it. You're supposed to be exercising your fiduciary duties to the company and to the stockholders. And if you're like, hey, this is not a good thing for all of the stockholders for you to do some self-dealing transaction, then yeah, right. Like you gotta speak up.
I'm getting upset about it right now, Beck. You know me, I'm such a, you know, it's just, I don't know if it's my Irish Catholic upbringing in Brooklyn and my dad. It's just, my dad was so principled as a Greek business owner, and my Irish Catholic mom and her family is just very principled. And man, it just gets my Irish up when literally somebody does something that's unethical or immoral or shady in any way. And I'm getting annoyed by it right now. But, you know, I do have one thing that keeps me from getting annoyed at it. People who do these kind of things, they tend to fail.
It is true. It is true.
It's almost universal. You and I went through a couple of wars, and like that company that we had, you know, a couple of companies we had that, you know, were a little dicey, they're no longer in existence. And we were able to save our investment and watch that company and that founder literally drive into a brick wall. And we were the only people who got out of the car, you know. And when you see a reckless driver, you know, it's an indication to me that people who do something reckless are doing more reckless things that you're not aware of, and they will do it again. And if they're rewarded for recklessness or bending rules, they can get the wrong message and they double down on that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, it kind of goes to character, right?
It goes to character, but and then also incentives. You know, we see in our industry, in order to run these companies, you have to be it's an extreme pursuit. And then in some cases, you know, you're bending some rules, reinterpreting some rules, you're disrupting, being a disruptor, but you just have to be careful. I don't recommend people become disruptive or destructive with legal issues and corporate issues. Just keep that one on the straight and narrow.
We've had a few examples, really high profile examples, right, over the last couple of years of perhaps bending, not walking the line delicately, but no, you are way, way over on the other side of the line.
You're literally like Wile E. Coyote running off the cliff, and like you just don't realize there's nothing underneath you, you know. And so many of the crypto companies we looked at, I said, and maybe we should end on this, you know, and I don't have anything against crypto, but when one of our crypto companies told us, meet our new Panamanian lawyers in the BVI, and we're setting up a nonprofit, and the nonprofit is got 5 directors, but we can't tell you who the directors are because of a safety risk. I'm like, well, I'm a director of the company that's spinning out the nonprofit in Panama through a BVI attorney. And you know how I knew this might not be a good situation? When the formation of the Panamanian nonprofit was $1 million in legal fees. And I was like, wait a second, I have the best attorney in the world, Becky at Wilson Sonsini, and she'll incorporate the next company, you know, or like the retainer. It's like, it's not what we're paying for. And I said to this woman who was doing this in the BVI, I said, I asked a question, why is it $1 million? She's like, well, there's some risk associated with it and it's complex. And I was like, we're paying you $1 million because it's risky? Like, I couldn't believe she said it out loud. She's like, well, maybe that's the wrong word. It's complex is really more the word. And I was like, yeah, I'm good.
Red flag, red flag, red flag.
I mean, literally, it was like somebody just took a case of red flags and dumped it on the table. And it's like, I'm not in the red flag business. All right, Becky, you're wonderful. Thank you for protecting me at all times and our startups. And if you are dealing with dicey situations, just call Becky. She's awesome. Her dance card's pretty full, but Wilson Sonsini always has some great attorneys over there. Man, wild rides. We've been on great adventures together. And, you know, every now and again, one of these companies wins big and it makes it all worthwhile. So thank you so much, Becky.
The joy of the ride, right?
It's a little wild at times. Bring some Dramamine, folks. If you want less legal fees and less volatility, don't be in the startup world. It's a little bit binary here, but great counsel makes it a lot easier. See you all next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Jason. Appreciate it.